gave a systematic presentation of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy and teachings. This Krishna Lila Stava, for those who weren't here for the previous session, takes the form of prayers. Sri Sanatana Goswami wrote four books. One of them we've already published, Brihadbhagavatamrita. And this is the shortest and simplest of his works, Krishna Lila Stava. Stava means prayers, and Krishna Lila means the pastimes of Lord Krishna. But Krishna Lila Stava summarizes Krishna's pastimes as they appear in Srimad Bhagavatam, starting from the very beginning and continuing up through the killing of Kamsa in Mathura, and it leaves off there. And in the course of these pastimes, Sanatana Goswami offers 108 obeisances. So he's, in one sense, punctuating his prayers or interspersing these offerings of dandavats, obeisance to Krishna. Or you can take it that each set of prayers is itself an obeisance to the Lord. The book is short by comparison to other works, but it gives us a sense of Sanatana Goswami's love and devotion for Krishna and his appreciation for the transcendental pastimes performed by the Lord. In the beginning of the book, before he gets to Krishna's pastimes, there are some other... This is ringing just a little bit. Mm-hmm. There are some... Hare Krishna, let's get this. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, is that all right? Okay. Before he begins reciting the actual pastimes of the Lord, which he does in shortcut fashion, a whole chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam he might summarize in one or two or three verses, maybe a few more, but they go quite quickly, so they're almost like code reminding us of these pastimes one after another. But before he gets there, he begins by expressing some other topics, including, and this is where we left off last time, he begins actually by appreciating the Brahman feature of Krishna. Krishna has three different features, we know, during the Srimad Bhagavatam. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Shabjate. He can be seen, he is one substance, Advaya Gyan, but he can be viewed from three different angles of vision, as the impersonal Brahma, as the localized Paramatma, and as the personality of Godhead. The first realization, we can say, is Brahman realization, in which one realizes the all-pervasiveness of the Supreme in a in some way. There's some reality which is greater than the prosaic, mundane reality that we see. There's something which, this is not really real, there's something more real which is behind all of this, or underlying all of this. There's a truth which is beyond the small and inconsequential varieties that we see. There's something greater. So one may intuitively perceive that, or by instruction or discipline, one may come to that point and get the sense that there's a supreme which is everywhere. But in a dispersed sort of fashion, there's no particular place, or even there's no that supreme has no form or qualities or name that we would ascribe. There's not even even we say, well, that would make him smaller. To put a name on him would be to diminish him, to limit him to a form. So there's just this general sense of the supreme. But going further, one may realize the presence of the supreme in one's own heart. Ishvara sarvabhutana pridesam. God is present within. I feel some direction which I'm getting. It's not just an all-pervading presence of God, but God is actually there with me. I feel him in my heart directing my wanderings, giving me some counsel which I sometimes accept and sometimes don't accept. But I have that experience that God is within my heart. And the yogis, by discipline, actually aim at direct perception of that form of God in the heart. Yoga, dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa pashanti yam yogi. The yogis, by their meditation, dhyana, being situated in dhyan, dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa pashanti, by their mental concentration, they want to directly see. Pashanti means see, as we're seeing one another. The yogis, by their concentrated meditation, by their exceedingly focused meditation on the Supreme, come to see God in their hearts as the Supreme guide within. They can see him. Dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa pashanti yami. That's the actual goal of yoga. It's not this business of feeling better and looking fit. It's actually seeing the super soul, or the paramatma in the heart. And beyond that, one may finally come to realize the supreme as the personality of God in him. To see that although the supreme is everywhere and although he's within my heart, has his own independent personal existence, as I do. I have my own personal existence. So the Supreme also has his personal existence. And that personal existence is not like my limited personal life, but he's unlimited. He's a person and I'm a person, but he's an unlimited person, a person with no restrictions placed upon him, because he's the Supreme Person. So one may come to realize Bhagavan. And of course, that's the real subject matter that Sanatana Goswami will come to, the pastimes of Bhagavan, who Bhagavan is, who Krishna is, what he does, what his powers are, what our relationship is with him. All of these things will be revealed as we read Srimad Bhagavatam. But before we come to Bhagavan, before we even come to Paramatma, first Sanatana Goswami is going to talk about Brahma, not in the usual philosophical way where we say, yes, there's this impersonal feature which we sometimes disparage and say, oh, you don't want to hear about that. But he's going to actually glorify the impersonal aspect of Krishna. We begin that. Did we begin that in the previous verse? No. Previous verse, he offered his obeisances to Krishna. That was the third verse of the text. And now he says, Nirvikara parichinna nirvishesha niranjana avyakta satyasan matra parama jyotir akshara. This is his offering of obeisance, offering of respect to the impersonal feature of Krishna. Although the Krishna himself, the personality of Godhead, shares these same characteristics, if you can call them characteristics, because the impersonal feature. It doesn't have characteristics. That's the nature of being impersonal, to say that it, therefore they'll use words like beyond description, beyond perception, beyond, you know, you can't say anything about Brahma, about the impersonal, because there's no form, there's no quality. As soon as you say qualities, no, he has no qualities. But we are going to talk about qualities nonetheless, that this quality-less absolute has, the quality of being without qualities, for example. But these same characteristics, Krishna also has in his personal feature, and we can talk about that. So the first thing he says is nirvikara. Vikara means change. We all go through changes. We were born, then we grow, then we stay for some time. We have some byproducts, some children. Then we start to deteriorate, dwindle, and finally we die. These are the changes that we all go through in the material world. Even material things go through so many changes. Yes, welcome. Wherever you'd like to sit. There you go. Okay. Thank you for coming. So we all go through these changes. The world is the world where everything changes. But the absolute is beyond, is changeless. There's nothing happening there in the way of time or any material influence that can bring about a change in the absolute. So we have a sense that here everything is changing, but there must be something beyond this changing world which is changeless. There's some underlying absolute which is changeless. So nirvikara, the absolute, the impersonal Brahmajyoti, involves no change. It's ever the same. It's ever the same. And Krishna, the personality of Godhead, is also unchanging. Although he appears in many different forms and performs many different activities, he's beyond the changes of this material world. He's not, for example, when he appears at Kurukshetra to speak Bhagavad Gita, he's about 125 years old, but he still looks like a young boy because he's not affected by this any material influence. So he's also beyond material change. His nature is like that. So nirvikara and aparichinna. The absolute is unbounded. There are no boundaries. You know, we come to America, and then you come to the border, and then you have to go through customs and talk to all these TSA people and have them go through your baggage and all of that because you've come to the border. Or we have our own personal borders. You know, say, wait, you're invading my personal space. We set our limits, our borders. Or anything, my knowledge has its limits, its boundaries. Everything has some boundary or some limitation. I'd like to fly, but I can't just walk out to the storefront and flap my wings and take off. The birds can do it, but I can't do that. I'm limited. I'm limited in so many ways. I'm limited. But the absolute truth is beyond all limitations. He has no beginning, he has no end. As our this book is translated by Gopi Pranadatta Prabhu, our Srila Prabhupada's disciple, and he's written a commentary also. And he says that aparichinna means impossible to delimit by any relative difference measured in space or time. You can't say, okay, we've reached the end of the truth. Here's where truth leaves off and something else begins. He's beyond all spatial limit. He's beyond all temporal limit. You can't say, okay, he lives for 25 years and then he ceases to exist. He's beyond space. He's beyond time. He's beyond any kind of limit that you might ascribe to him. In the Bhagavatam, Nachantara na bahir yasya napurvam napi chapadam purvapadam bahishchantar jagato yo jagatchayaha. The absolute truth, or the personality of Godhead, or the Brahman absolute, has no beginning, no end, no within, no without, no front, no rear, all-pervading, not under the influence of the element of time, and so for the absolute, there's no difference between past and present and future. And then, he exists in his own transcendental form at all times. When we speak of the personality of Godhead, he always exists that way. Or the impersonal absolute also is beyond all material form. And being absolute, beyond relativity, is free from distinctions between cause and effect, although that absolute is the cause and effect of everything. So this is aparichinna. Aparichinna, yes. And then, nirvishesha. Vishesha means specific characteristics. Vishesha, specific varieties. And nirvishesha means without varieties. No distinctions whatsoever. Here we have so many people all buried. Some are men, some are women, some are old, some are young, some are from Brooklyn, some are from Queens, some are from New Jersey. So many different people, from some are from India. So many distinctions. But when we come to the absolute, nirvishesha, no distinctions whatsoever. The term is interesting because in the mantra that we chant in honor of Srila Prabhupada, we find nirvishesha shunyavadi paschacha desha tarane. He was the enemy of the doctrine that everything is nirvishesha, that everything is ultimately without specific characteristics. But here we find that the absolute truth is nirvishesha. So how do we resolve this? In one sense, the Goswamis say that everything is resolved in the absolute truth. All opposites, all contradictions are resolved in the absolute truth. The absolute truth is not here, not there, and yet he's everywhere. In the Ishopanishad, it's said that he's very near and he's very far away. He's within everything, yet he's outside everything. He's standing in one place, but he outruns everyone. So this is the absolute truth, that entity which resolves all contradictions, or who is beyond all contradictions. So nirvishesha, no varieties whatsoever. But that means no material varieties. The nirvishesha philosophers that Srila Prabhupada was so much at war with are those who say that in the absolute there's no variety whatsoever. Because the material world means variety. And look at it, it's lousy. It's a world of suffering, it's a world where everything has a beginning and an end, it's a world of strife, it's a world of duality. The absolute can't have any of that. Otherwise, what kind of absolute would it be? So the absolute, there must be no variety. It must be the opposite. But this is an imperfect way of understanding the Absolute, and even it's relative. Because what is the Absolute? The Absolute is the opposite of the material world. Well, then you're making him relative to the material world. If I'm saying, you know, you're not German, then I'm speaking about you in relationship to Germany. Even though it's negative, you're not German. But it's in relationship to Germany. So when I say the Absolute Truth is not this or that, I'm really describing him in relationship to this or that. It's not an independent conception. It's a conception that depends on this or that. So this is a speculative way of understanding the Supreme, or a philosophical way. We try to understand what the Supreme is and say, well, it couldn't be like this, it couldn't be like that, it couldn't be limited, couldn't be subject to the conditions of this material world. And so, well, then what is he like? Well, he's not this, he's not, it's all a negative conception. It's a large inventory of what he's not. Just like that first word, nirvikara, all this nir means without. No change, no limits, no varieties. The next word is another nir word, niranjana. Not this, not this, not this, not this. So it's a kind of way of describing, just I was telling Pradyumna's where to find something. I said, it's not in this box. It's not in that closet. It's not here. It's not there. Not in any of these places. But finally, I also have to tell him where it is. That's another thing. But the first thing is, don't look here. It's not in this box. It's not in that closet. It's not over there. It's not over here. So in that way, or we describe, what is Krishna consciousness? Well, it's not like Christianity. It's not Judaism, it's not a mundane religion, it's not this, it's not that. But someplace along the line I have to come along and say, well, actually what it is, otherwise it's an incomplete description. So the Mayavad description, those who are the Nirvishesh followers, they're right. They say the Absolute is not this or this or this or this, but they have no means to come to what he is. So they can go part of the way. And they're obstructed from going further because of the method that they've chosen. Because their method is so much dependent on negating material characteristics, they have a hard time conceiving of spiritual characteristics. Their experience of distinctions is so bitter that if you tell them that on the spiritual level there are also distinctions, they can't compute that, because distinction means material. Form means material. Qualities means material. Personality means material. Because that's their experience, and that their approach to the Absolute Truth is not this, not this, not this, not this. So if you say, well, there's this, no, there's not. It's based on a kind of misunderstanding that Srila Prabhupada calls cow in the barn philosophy. You may not be familiar, you've probably heard of Heidegger and Kant and many others, but you may not be familiar with cow in the barn philosophy. This is cow in the barn philosophy. One time there was a fire in the barn, and now whenever the cow sees red, she thinks it's fire. That's cow in the barn philosophy. So how does that apply? These philosophers are thinking about the Absolute, very deeply contemplating the Absolute, and they know that personality is a problem, qualities are a problem, forms are problematic. All of these dualities and distinctions of the material world are a problem. So when you tell me that there's a personality of Godhead, that he has a form, that he has qualities, activities, no, these are material. Because that's their experience, that form and quality and activity means material form, material qualities, material. So they think that this must extend to the Absolute also. The Absolute cannot have these things. Because their experience is that these things are always material. They can't conceive that there could be form and quality and activity, which is of a different nature entirely. That is beyond them. So their idea of nirvishesha is no qualities whatsoever, no variety, only oneness. It's beyond the varieties of the material world. It's there, everything is one. And we say also that everything is one. Ultimately, there's nothing but Krishna. But Krishna includes so many varieties, spiritual varieties, parasya shakti vrividaiva shriyate, because he has different energies. Electricity is one, but electricity heats, electricity refrigerates, although it's one. Money is one, but you build a college, you build a factory, you build a retreat, you build so many things with the same one money, but the one money can be transformed into so many things. So everything is one, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that although everything is one, everything is also different. Everything is one with Krishna, everything is simultaneously different from Krishna. There's transcendental variety. And at the same time, that transcendental variety is inconceivably one. Krishna is indivisible. You can't divide Krishna from his form, from his qualities, from anything, actually. Even material things are also Krishna, in an ultimate sense. Yet at the same time, they're not Krishna. Matsthani sarvabhutani nachaham teshvarastha. The Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, everything is in me, yet I'm not in them. He brings forward the same idea, that I'm one with everything, and yet I'm different from everything. So, nirvishesha, Krishna is beyond all differences, and niranjana, uncontaminated. Niranjana. The niranjana means beyond all the taints of suffering. Anjana can mean taint. So niranjana, again, nir, not, no taint, no trace of suffering. And then there's a further derivation of different things that can be said from this anjana. But in summary, for example, one meaning of anj is to move. So niranjana means he's not moving, he's unmoving, he's always the same. Why? He has nowhere to go. Why nowhere to go? Because he's everything. There's nothing outside of him. And yet, there's so many places that he goes. Then avyakta. Vyakta means visible. Vyakta is manifest. And avyakta, not manifest or invisible. So that's another feature of the Supreme, because the Supreme is beyond all subject-object duality. He can't be seen by any material means. Avyakta. You can't just walk out the door and see the Absolute. It's hidden. Avyakta, not manifest. That's true of the impersonal Absolute. It's also true of Krishna. Krishna's not to be seen by any material means. Avyakta. And avyakta and satya, eternal, eternally true. Satya means the truth. When we're speaking of the absolute is true. The impersonalists also say, Brahma Satya, the absolute is the supreme truth. And Sanmatra, unconditioned existence, simply existence. Matra can be taken as being that simply existing. Sanmatra, unconditioned existence. What does Vibhandan Prabhu say? Yeah. Sanmatra. Taking it to refer to Krishna, Satyavratam Satyaparam Trisatyam Satyasya Yonim Nihatam Trisatye Satyasya Satyam Ritasatya Netram Satyatmakam Tram Sharanam Vipanna. You, just by hearing, you can understand that Krishna is Satya in many different ways. The demigods were praying to Krishna before he appeared, when he was in the womb of his mother. You never deviate from your vow, which is always perfect, because whatever you decide is perfectly correct and cannot be stopped by anyone. Satyavrata, one who is true to his vow. Being present in the three phases of cosmic time manifestation, creation, maintenance, and annihilation, you are the supreme truth. So, Trisatyam, we're true in these three different phases. Satyaparam, you're the supreme truth. Unless one is completely truthful, one cannot achieve your favor, which therefore cannot be achieved by hypocrites. You are the active principle, the real truth, in all the ingredients of creation, and therefore you are known as Antaryami, the inner force. You're equal to everyone, and your instructions apply for everyone for all time. You're the beginning of all truth, and therefore, offering our obeisances, we surrender to you. Kindly give us protection. So in this way, the demigods are praising Krishna as the supreme truth, Satyaparam, Trisatyam, Satyasanmatra. Yes. And Param is the supreme, and Jyoti, effulgent, or Param Jyoti, he's the supreme effulgence. And Akshara. Akshara means inexhaustible. How is it given here? Yeah, infallible, inexhaustible. Akshara means fallible, and Akshara, infallible. Again, the same thing, the opposite of fallible, the opposite of false, the opposite of tainted, the opposite of... So Krishna... Or the Krishna is the opposite of everything material. In the beginning stage, that's our realization. He's not this, he's not this, he's not this, he's beyond this, he's beyond this. God must be beyond, 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 beyond. We have that idea, there must be something beyond. There must be something higher, there must be something beyond, there must be something greater, there must be something not limited, not tainted, not fallible. So that brings us to some sort of understanding of a greater truth, a greater entity. And this is the first phase of realization of the Supreme. Okay? Brahman realization. So Sanatana Goswami offers his respects to Krishna, who manifests himself or reveals himself, or who is intuitively perceived in this impersonal, all-pervading feature. That's his where he's beginning, and he'll proceed from here next to offer his respects to the Paramatma, to Krishna within the heart, and finally he'll speak at length about the personality of Godhead, the ultimate feature of the absolute truth of Krishna. All right, do we have some questions? Gail's here, so we have some questions. Excuse me? Doesn't matter whether the what the lecture was, you have questions anyway. But does anyone have any questions about the talk? Yes.
Maharaj, you talked about the certain kind of philosophers whom Prabhupada smashed in his books, and would you still say that the impersonal feature, but Sanatana Goswami here is glorifying the impersonal feature. What is the difference between a person who respects it, another person who respects it, but one being correct, another being wrong?
What's the difference between one who respects the impersonal feature and another who doesn't?
He also respects, but one is right.
One respects it properly, one respects it improperly. Srila Prabhupada, I should add, sometimes does glorify or extol or speak of the impersonal absolute. Sometimes you may read in Srila Prabhupada's books where he's really speaking from the point of view of oneness. We read a purport like that in the Bhagavad Gita a few weeks ago, where Srila Prabhupada was really, in the ninth chapter, where Srila Prabhupada is really stressing that Krishna, that everything is Krishna. Where Pitaham Asya Jagato Mata Tata Pitamaha. Your mother is also Krishna. Your father is also Krishna. The chief of the demigods, Lord Brahma, is also Krishna. Mata Tata Pitamaha. Everything is Krishna. He's really speaking from, you know, an angle of oneness, making no distinction. And sometimes Prabhupada will speak that way. He'll say that Sarva Kalavidam Brahma, that everything is Brahma, that everything is ultimately one indivisible absolute truth. But when Srila Prabhupada speaks that, it's with an awareness that this absolute, indivisible, formless absolute is a display of one feature of Krishna. It's one aspect of the absolute truth. It's not the only realization. It's not even the ultimate realization. But it's one of three features by which one may realize or perceive or approach the absolute. That's the difference. The Mayavadis, the people that Srila Prabhupada is fighting, they say that's everything. When you get to that, that's it. When you realize that everything's one, you've made it. Now you've understood that there's no difference between everything and everything else. There's really only one undifferentiated substance, Brahma. Now you've understood. That's the they're called Kevala Dvaita. Advaita means oneness or non-duality. Dvaita means duality, two. Dvaita. And Advaita, no two-ness, only oneness. Kevala Advaita, absolutely, exclusively, purely, 100%, nothing but oneness. Kevala Advaita. But there are other kinds of Advaita realization. Srila Ramanujacharya speaks of Vishishtadvaita, specific oneness, oneness in which there's qualified oneness, oneness in which there's still individuality, just as we're all here and we're all one because we're all interested in Krishna consciousness, or we're all human beings, we're all in New York, we're all somethings, we have, there's oneness among us. We're all one. But I'm talking to you, you're listening to me, every one of us is an individual person, so although we're one, there's individuality. There's individuality at the same time that there's oneness. So if we say there's only oneness, it's really, in a strange sort of way, limited. Although the idea of such realization is to be beyond limits, it's actually a limiting understanding. It's actually a limiting understanding, because the absolute truth can't have form, can't have name, can't have qualities, can't have pastimes, can't do this, can't do that. He's, at the same time you're saying that he's unlimited, you just placed 50,000 limitations on it. So it's a contradictory sort of realization. So there's oneness, just like my cloth. It's cotton. I think it's cotton. It's cotton. So there's no difference between cotton and my cloth. My cloth is nothing but cotton. It's not something other than cotton. It's not, God forbid, you know, one of those synthetic things, poly whatever it is. It's not wool in the middle of August in New York. It's not, you know, so many things that it could otherwise be. It's not, it's only cotton. It's purely cotton. It's nothing but cotton. Yet, at the same time, it's different from what's growing out there in the fields. One time, Srila Prabhupada, I've told this story before, Srila Prabhupada was at a program in Boston, I forget which university it was, maybe Northwestern or someplace, and after his lecture, there was a kind of a large hall, into a large area in which people were taking prasad and seeing books, you know, it was kind of a hangout area of that. We were mixing with all the people who'd come to the lecture. And there were a lot of people, actually. It was a very big program. And all of a sudden, this big ripple went through the room. You know, like when something happens, and a ripple, everybody's talking, it's just like a wave goes through the room. And this big wave went through the room. And I was far away from the beginning of the wave, and I didn't know what had happened. And even when I asked, nobody seemed to know. Afterwards, I found out what had happened. There was some professor, an Indian man, who was a professor at the university, and who was strongly pushing this point that everything is one, there's nothing beyond this, it's all one. Srila Prabhupada had finally an exasperation, apparently, because the man wasn't getting it. You know, no argument would suffice. Finally, Srila Prabhupada took hold of him by the shirt, and shook him, and said, "If everything is one, then why don't you wear a cotton ball instead of a shirt?" I think that finally put an end to the man's argument. No, but that's the problem with everything is one, is that at the same time, if everything is one, where do all these varieties come from? Oh, that's just illusion. Well, where'd illusion come from? If you have oneness and you have illusion by which you can't realize that everything is one, all of a sudden you have two. You know, so how does that work? It doesn't really work. So therefore the Vaishnava philosophers have said, no, there's oneness, but within that oneness, there's transcendental variety. There's no material variety of the sort that we encounter and suffer with here. but there's transcendental variety. So Srila Prabhupada was perfectly capable of appreciating that the absolute truth is ultimately one, that everything is ultimately not different from the absolute truth. But at the same time, he understood that this doesn't prohibit the absolute truth from having absolute variety. Something else? Mm-hmm.
So can you please tell a little bit more about the material variety and the transcendental variety?
Material variety and transcendental variety. Well, material variety is temporary. Whatever buried things we may find here don't last. So they're temporary. They're subject to limitations in knowledge. I'm here, but I don't know everything. You don't know everything. None of us knows everything. So the material world is the world where there's limits on knowledge. And finally, where there's not actual happiness. The happiness of this material world is, from the transcendental viewpoint, not considered happiness. At best, it's considered relief from distress. The explanation is given, you know, during older days before they developed modern methods of giving people a hard time, they take some criminal and just take him out in a boat into the middle of the water, grab him by the hair, push him down under, and then when he was practically dead, they'd pull him up for a moment and then push him under again. Ways of dealing with criminals. And they'd push him under again. So for the moment he's pulled up, that's the happiness of the material world. Get a little relief from abject misery. Oh, thank God. Now that's the material variety. Asada chit nirananda. Temporary, subject to ignorance, and finally miserable. Every one of us wants to have happiness here, and our happiness is always frustrated. And we always, you know, put on a brave face, but the fact is that you know, somebody's frustrated, we call a psychiatrist, but the psychiatrist is frustrated with somebody else. And it's a world of frustration. Everyone is finally frustrated. Our dreams are not achievable, or we achieve them and they're not what we thought they would be, or we achieve them and then we lose them. It's a frustrating world. It's just built that way. So in the spiritual world, there's form, there's quality, there's activity, there's individuality, but it's beyond all of these limits. It's not temporary, it's permanent. It's not subject to ignorance. It's shining with knowledge. And it's always joyful, unadulterated. All of these things that are said here, it's beyond all of these material taints. So the material world is said to be like a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. There's happiness here, but it's not the actual happiness. It's a reflection of the happiness. There's beauty here, but it's a reflection. It doesn't last. It's imperfect in so many ways. There's everything is here, but then when you go for it, it's not really here. It's not true. You know, we look for love in the material world, but the love is kind of falsely constructed because I want something and you want something, so we call it love, but it's really, I'll do something for you if you'll do something for me, and it's like a business deal. And then, you know, when I don't get what I want, then the deal's off. You know, that's the true love of the material world. Or the true love, you know, I'll love you forever, you'll love me forever, and then you die on me. You know, so the true love is not true in the sense that it doesn't last. I'll love you, you know, all right, you die on me, I go on loving you, and then I die on me. You know, it's all defeated. Material world, everything is ultimately, it all ends in defeat. So the spiritual world is not like that. It's the place where the actual thing is there. The Prophet explained by giving an example that there was some bird, and he saw some fruits, but they were in a mirror. So he's pecking on the fruits, but he's not actually, you know, you peck on a fruit and you get some taste, but he's pecking on a fruit and he's hurting his beak. Because it's not the actual fruit, it's a reflection. It looks something like a fruit, has, you know, a lot of the characteristics that a fruit does, but it's not a fruit. So the material world, it seems like it's everything we want it to be, except that it's not. It's a perverted reflection. Mm-hmm.
So in that perspective, when you say that it's a perverted reflection, so does it mean that, how is that then different from, like, when you try to worship the Lord or offer our food to the Lord, how is that different from the perverted reflection? How is that an exception to the perverted reflection?
Now I'm offering you something, you're offering me something, but the... I may be ungrateful, I may not appreciate it, I may accept it, you know, because I was stuck with it and I think how to get rid of it, or I accept it, you know, in spite of what I think of you, or, you know, in so many ways. Or I accept it and I really appreciate it and then it, you know, it gets old and then I don't want it anymore, or it breaks, or, you know, so many things. Or the relationship also. Alright, I offer you something, but I expect something. In the material world, I offer you something, but I expect something. But on the spiritual platform, we offer to Krishna, and the relationship is temporary. I offer you something. Why? Because I love you, or I respect you, or I want to show my appreciation for you. But the relationship that I form with you is not going to last. Either you're going to say, well, all right, he does this for me, but, you know, like, girl, you know, he gives me this, but he gives me that. You know, so then you get tossed in the dustbin. The relationship is broken. Or, you know, I'm in business. I do something for you. I offer you a good deal. You offer me your business. But then later on somebody offers you a better deal. So you go over there and you become his customer. So it's not a permanent relationship. Family relationships, they're formed under certain circumstances, and under certain circumstances later, it's all split up, either because of disagreement or because of death. But the relationship that you form with Krishna is real in the sense that it's permanent. It's not something constructed to try to make the best of the bad bargain of this material world. It actually exists. I make a relationship with you based on some idea of something. I don't actually have any relationship with you in that, you know, in material terms. It's just something we construct. And maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't work out. It's something, you know, take the good with the bad. But with Krishna, you have a permanent relationship. The relationship is permanent. The relationship is based on true knowledge. Krishna is the Supreme. I'm actually part of Krishna. It's not based on the illusion that I'm, you know, I'm strong and handsome and she's beautiful and faithful and, you know, all these things that we, you know, she's the best thing that ever happened in my life. And, you know, it's not based on this kind of stuff. It's based on reality. Krishna's actually the master. I'm actually the servant. That's actually an eternal relationship. And the happiness is not kind of sort of imagined or constructed happiness. It's constitutional happiness. It's the happiness that actually belongs to the soul, that's inherent in the soul, by nature of its true relationship with Krishna. just like a kid, you know, a kid leaves home and now I'm happy because I've done stuff. But, you know, pretty soon he's miserable. But when he's at home and his parents are taking nice care of him and he's, and everything's there, that's his natural relationship. That's his natural position. And when we're in our natural position, then there's all of these things. So that when we offer something to Krishna, we're expressing, we're acting in that permanent relationship, real relationship.
So that's not, that does not fall under the purview of the parvati?
No, it's not the, when the bird turns away from the mirror, hey, the real fruit's over here. It may seem that it's the same thing. Now he's pecking. But what happens? He puts his beak in and he actually gets a little bit of juice. He actually gets, you know, he's getting a fruitier. Whereas over here, he was just getting, you know, mirror. So there's a resemblance between the fruit here and the fruit there. But when he turns away from this and turns toward that, he's getting the real thing. If he turns away from the mirror and just looks at nothing, that's not, you know, then you're neither here nor there. Okay, you're free from pecking on the mirror, your beak gets a rest, but you're not getting any fruit. That's the Mayavadis. They've turned away from the false thing, but they haven't quite understood the real thing, the real variety. If there's false variety here, where did it come from? There had to be a real variety that they don't see. They've just gone to the, all right, no material variety. But that's what there isn't. What is there? They're not clear about it. Mm-hmm.
So the absolute real thing is unconditional?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The absolute real thing is unconditional.
Maharaj, a couple of months ago we were having kirtan in here and one gentleman came in. Everyone was kind of dancing and smiling and laughing. Not laughing, but they were happy. And his comment was that, you know, there's so much suffering in the world. How could you be happy like this?
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking, like, what should be the devotee's kind of view of life? Because we understand also there's a lot of suffering going on. At the same time, when we see ourselves, how far away we are from the goal, that also is kind of a sad you know, realization. So, but yet we're told we're supposed to be happy.
We're chanting Hare Krishna, but like a basic instruction, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. But then there's so many people unhappy in the world, so how can we be happy? Yes. From one angle of vision, my being unhappy is not going to help them. You know, they're suffering, so I should also suffer. That doesn't help their problem. You know, they have diphtheria, so how could I not have diphtheria? That's the first thing. The second thing is that a devotee, although always happy, does feel unhappy for those who are not, who are missing Krishna's love. Shocheta tovi mukocheta sindriya. Prahlad Maharaj says, Naivod Vijay, I have no anxiety. Why? Tadbir yugaya namahamritamandati. I can chant your glories. I just merge in the ocean of bliss. Mahamritamandati. But shocheta tovi mukocheta sindriya. But I am unhappy. Why? Vimukacheta, for those who've turned away from you. And not only have they turned away from you, but why have they turned away from you? Indriyartha, for the sake of sense gratification, which is not real, which is frustrating. Indriyartha, for this sense gratification, they've turned away from the absolute, from the supreme reality, from the reservoir of bliss, for sense gratification. Maya sukaya bharamudvahato vimudha. These fools, vimudha, have gone for maya sukha. Illusory happiness. Happiness that's not there. And for the sake of that happiness, bharamudvahato, they've created a whole a we've created a monstrous civilization. They've created a burdensome civilization full of cars and trucks and polluted air and war over petroleum and individuals fighting with so many things. They've created all of this for false happiness. So for them, I'm unhappy, shortchanged to them. Therefore, the devotees, it's not that sometimes it's depicted in the Hare Krishna movement, they're just, self-centered. It's another one of those self-centered, spiritual meditational groups where they're just interested in pursuing their own, liberation or their own, whatever it is, their own experience. It's another New Age thing where they turn in on themselves and it's all about me, all about my realization, all about my liberation, my this and my that. But the fact is that why is Krishna consciousness movement always so busy trying to reach out to others? Because we see that others are suffering, so there's that we're not happy because we see that they're suffering. But it doesn't mean that every minute we have to be suffering because people are suffering in this place or that place or this place. And I can still realize the happiness of my relationship with Krishna at the same time that I feel unhappiness. It's also another one of those. It's not limited, but if I'm happy, then I can't feel something for others who are not happy. Both things are there.
For a devotee who's not very advanced, who's not experiencing this relationship with Krishna, he's seeing his own struggles. So then what is his source of happiness? So we're seeing the suffering in the world, and we're also struggling for ourselves.
We see unhappiness in the world, that's the first thing. Before I can have the leisure to think about the sufferings of others, if I myself am suffering like a dog. The people who are, say in Afghanistan, getting bombs, getting their homes bombed and so on, or Iraq nowadays, getting their homes bombed, you can be sure they're not thinking about the poor starving people in, Ethiopia or something, because they're suffering so much. So in the beginning, we come to Krishna consciousness. We're suffering so much in material life. So we don't even come to that point of thinking about, those poor people over here, those poor people over there. First thing is, I'm so miserable. So then the first thing is to do something about that. All right, now that I've risen above the pit of misery that I was in, the frustrations, the way that I was trying to somehow or other do this or do that to get free from suffering, now that I've actually come to the spiritual platform, now the next thing is, all right, now I've got some relief. Now what about these other people? It's not the same thing. A plane is down or something. First thing is you got out of the plane. That's your first concern. Now the next thing, what about all these other people? Then he tries to rescue them. Yes?
So to go along with Ghanashyam's question, as far as our own individual suffering in Krishna consciousness, what should we be doing when we feel this sort of notion of being lower than a blade of grass or in the straw in the street, but we don't have that advancement, we don't have that knowledge to feel the ecstasy of Krishna supporting us that goes along with it. So how do we can call out louder in our chanting, but what if sometimes we're frustrated in that? Or what if we are able to call out more sincerely in our chanting, but we're still sort of suffering to see Krishna's hand in everything, and it's like...
Suffering to see Krishna's hand?
We're still struggling to see Krishna's hand in everything, so we're still in this mode of feeling the material pangs everywhere.
Is this a time note?
So I'll just maybe...
Yeah, that's...
After,
We'll take it offline, or
yeah,
should,
maybe.
Or should I give a short answer?
Definitely.
I should. A short answer to a long question.
Sorry.
I suppose the short answer is that that's part of recovery. To recognize, you know, I see, wow, I've got a disease here. Whoa. And you look at it and then, you know, maybe you think, wow, this is more serious than I thought. And I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to get free from this. And what if it gets worse? And you know, so many things. But then if it's a curable disease and you've got the right medicine, the right treatment, then you know, that's the first stage. The first thing is to realize you've got it, because if you don't realize you have it, then it's like you're going to die. But if you come to that realization, well, I've got it bad, it's not something I'm going to fix by taking vitamins and then, you know, breathing deeper, I need some serious help here. Well, then that's the beginning of your cure. You find yourself a qualified doctor, you get the right direction about what to do, and you start doing it. And then you're on the road to recovery. Okay, we shall stop here, lest the neighbors be subjected to suffering and misery.